It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock, and welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, helping us review this week's news. It's Green Councillor for Ashley Ward, Rob Telford. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, if we manage to get past with the CD player playing our theme, we'll see. Bristol's Festival of Ideas, which are largely funded by the taxpayer, that's us. But the so-called big business charities that part fund and run it ensure really challenging ideas that challenge the status quo are never given an airing. It should more rightly be called the Bristol Festival of Established Approved Ideas. Take tonight's sell-out talk with Guardian columnist Owen Jones, for example. Media Lens have pointed out glaring gaps in his analysis and have dared to ask, as he speaks in Bristol to a sell-out audience at the festival tonight, is Owen Jones' success due to his keeping his mouth shut on the big issues like media ownership, money and land reform that could really make a change? And coal is supposed to be a dirty word, ho-ho. But is it really? There are hundreds of years of it under the ground and it's plentiful supply, and it's the main reason steam was retained on Britain's railways until the late 1960s, until the oil industry hatchet man Dr. Beeching moved in. Coal was the heart of the matter in the biggest strike Britain has ever seen in 1984 to 1985, and a film all about it, Still the Enemy Within, that's about the miners' strike, is airing next week in Bristol. Martin Upchurch will be here to tell us why we need to have a cold, hard look at how the strike was broken. Also, former Fraud Squad detective Rowan Bosworth Davis has said it. The annual Cambridge Conference on Financial Crime has said it. Thousands of people who've lost their homes, their farms and their livelihoods have said it. They are financial crime pays in our system, and the banking fraternity is above the law. The most successful banks are also the most crooked, and when they get caught in the act, no directors or senior managers are jailed or even fined. Tonight we hear from one organisation that's bringing the victims together to fight back. That's Jeremy Rowe from Bully Banks. Plus Martin Summers' chance to take us on the world's hotspot tour in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 13 Celsius with some showers and gusty winds. This weekend, highs of 17. More showers on Saturday, sunnier on Sunday and also breezy at times. Highs of 16 degrees Celsius next week, a fairly sunny week with some showers and gusty winds again. Next weekend, that's the 25th and 26th of October, highs of 13 Celsius and fairly sunny. So, helping us review this week's news, it's Green Councillor for Ashley Ward, Rob Telford. Hi Rob, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi Tony.
Some news this week, hasn't there been, about TV debates? Let's kick off with that, because understandably the Green Party are rather annoyed, since you've had a MP for, was it four years. Now, yeah. And literally within a couple of days of UKIP getting their first MP, the big news networks, media companies, the barons are on the TV all over the place, radio, etc., saying, oh, we want UKIP to do one of these big TV debates, even though they've only just, literally within days, got their first MP.
I mean, you've mentioned the first aspect, which is that we are on level pegging with UKIP within the parliamentary system in the UK. I mean, as much as the parliamentary system needs reform, that's where we've got to. And we've got to it from a status of a popularly elected Green campaigner for decades, Caroline Lucas in Brighton, whereas the UKIP MP is just someone who's just swapped from the Tories and decided to defect purely for seemingly publicity reasons. The other thing to bear in mind is that we're, you know, level pegging pretty much with the Liberal Democrats nationally in opinion polls, and we beat them in the European elections. We've got three MEPs now, they've only got one, so it doesn't really bear much scrutiny, the idea that we should be left out, even just on the pure numbers, even on the if on the broader, you know, effect of it is that we should be in anyway, because we're one of the top five parties, we should definitely be in it. If you look at any of the Scandinavian nations, they all have debates where they have 8-9 candidates, because that's how many parties are in contention, purely because they have a fair proportional voting system, so they can actually have this, the breadth of opinion, people can decide from all of the options, not just the ones that the, as you've said, the corporate media once.
Well, it's more grist to the mill, isn't it, that actually it's big corporations, big banks, big media, Martin, that actually call the shots. For example, also the MP Douglas Carswell, was it, that re-stood, he didn't have to re-stand at all, he could just announce, right, I'm going to defect to UKIP, but he did, and that was the only way that they could definitively say, right, this is a UKIP MP, because in the by-election they voted for him. So it does look like the whole thing has been staged just to give an excuse for UKIP to be brought in on the TV debate.
Well, I'm I'm inclined to agree. I mean, the system is at fault here. We don't have a two-party system in Britain. We haven't had one for years, if we ever did have one. And, of course, what about Alex Salmon? Perhaps he should be included. No doubt he will be in Scotland. But, I mean, the point is, what about the Ulster Unionists? I mean, the fact is that the whole thing is rigged. UKIP are being given all sorts of legs up by their supporters in the media and elsewhere. And... It's not fair.
Well, in the old days, I suppose if you go back to Victorian times, you used to have hustings in the street, didn't you?
Yeah.
Where the MP would stand up, everyone would cluster around, or at least those people who were interested in voting would, and have a listen to them. I've interviewed people who, for example, after the Second World War, were around, and they would listen to people, and they say, "Well, I'm going to vote for this chap because they heard them directly." Now it all comes through the media, and it seems to me that the media are calling the shots. I would have thought, surely, a parliamentary committee or somebody should be telling the media, "You're going to have a debate with these people."
Well, you'd have thought so, wouldn't you? But as you said, as we've pointed out, the media is very much being manipulated, and I think that we're going to have to. We really need to reconsider the way we do elections. Full stop. And this is just a symptom of that.
The other thing, of course, is it focuses everything on the party leaders and the hierarchy at the top of the party, Rob. Obviously, that's not so good for people like you.
No.
And it's also not so realistic, is it? The people who you're actually voting for are not them. They're somebody else in the local area. So how would you like to see this all changed?
Well, I mean, I think if you accept the fact that we've got these TV debates, which I don't, I mean, as you just said, I mean, it doesn't broaden the influence of politicians across the board. It just gives the leaders a pulpit, as it were. But if we're going to have it, then I think we should have four different debates. I think we should have, first of all, a debate about the action of people in government. So we should have the parties who have formed the government before being scrutinised on their actions in government. So that should be the first debate. Second debate should be, as Martin's mentioned, you know, actually looking at the regions and looking at the nations and saying, let's have a debate about Scotland, debate about Wales, debate about Northern Ireland, maybe one for England, but I don't think that's necessary. And then the third debate should be something where we look at the whole breadth of opinion. That's what we've been talking about, this sort of eight-person debate. So you actually have cross-examination of all of the party's policies. And then maybe towards the end you can narrow down slightly and say, oh, actually, who's polling highest? You know, who's actually going to get the most votes in this election and perhaps be in charge of the economy? And there is an argument there, and I am a Democrat, so I do believe that if a party has over 20% of the vote, it's likely they're going to form a government. So that means they're probably going to be Labour and Tory. But we don't know that, do we? What you need to do is have the debate with all the parties to start with, and we saw last time with Nick Clegg, you know, he got on the debate and the Lib Dems polls shot up hugely because people simply knew he existed. And that is the level we're at in Britain at the moment, is that people don't engage with the politics of the ruling elite, which is what they basically are. The people who are in Westminster don't represent us anymore.
Well, all you need to do is buy up a few TV channels and a few political parties and you run the entire show from behind the scenes. Anyway, One of my gripes about all this is we seem to have come a million miles away from real democracy, and I'd like to go back to the 1970s to an election which I think was probably the only or the last election where we had any real choice in this country over which way we were going to be governed, because it is in fact the 40th anniversary of the second election, which took place in 1974. Maybe Martin, you'd like to say something about this, because at the time there was a very slim majority that Harold Wilson had got in early 1974 for the Labour Party, and he decided after a few months to go to the country again to get a decisive majority. And he didn't get a decisive majority, but he got a bigger one, and enabled him to enact quite a lot of laws that he wanted to as part of their manifesto. So just tell us how, you know, what were things like back there, and how has it all changed? Because it seems the TV now is dominating.
It couldn't work now, because back in the day, the Prime Minister could call a snap election. It was one of the things a Prime Minister
Gordon
could
Brown
do.
Could have done that a couple of years ago.
But now we couldn't, because the coalition have brought in this you know, full Parliament Act. In actual fact, of course, if they lost control of the House of Commons, I think that would cause a constitutional crisis, because they wouldn't necessarily be able to govern, but they couldn't carry on governing. It hasn't happened because the coalition's held together. But I mean, we have had a very, very long Parliament. We've had a whole extra year. You'd normally have expected the election to be happening this May.
Also, it's allowed the party in power, the Conservatives really, the Lib Dems seem to be kind of totally sidelined, to deviate a great deal from what they originally said they were going to do, without worrying about having another election coming along on the horizon.
Well, that's right. It was more. How's the word? It was more fluid in the past. although of course giving the Prime Minister the right to call an election gives them an awful lot of power. In the US they've got fixed term elections, they've always had fixed term elections, so we're bringing in another aspect of the US system into the British system, perhaps not to the advantage of ourselves.
For example, if Labour Party had won a very, very narrow majority at the last election and wanted to have another election 6 months down the line to say, look, we think that, you know, we can now sell this better to the public will buy it and vote for us again, they can't do that anymore.
Well, I think the idea behind having fixed term parliaments is it gives stability, but what it also means is you've got no flexibility in the middle of a crisis, geopolitical and economic crisis, the worst in a generation. You might want to change tack in the middle of the parliament, but of course you can't under the present setup, because which is supposedly providing stability, but is actually providing stasis and lack of flexibility.
Would you call stability what George Osborne's been doing with the economy, Rob?
No, not in the slightest. But then I think it's an overrated virtue in politics. I think stability is being well governed, and if you've got someone in power who you believe isn't governing you well, then why would you want that stability? So I think it's part of the rhetoric that particularly the Conservative Party used, particularly after the last general election, where we were like, we must form a coalition quickly. I mean, there's countries in Europe who take, you know, weeks to form coalitions because they negotiate. They find, okay, I mean, I accept what Tony said about you know, it's not worth the paper it's written on the manifesto if you have to, you know, compromise. But effectively, if you take time over a coalition, if you have a coalition, I don't have a problem with coalitions as long as they've properly been worked out what each party is going to get from it and the lines have been drawn. Basically, the Lib Dems have been completely sidelined, as you say, because they've just had to kind of capitulate to whatever the Tories want.
Well, they could have actually really twisted the arm of the Tories to get a lot more out of it, I think. But anyway, Clegg's still in charge. He's going to get a complete disaster at the elections next year. But anyway, let's go back now 40 years to the last honourable, honest general election this country ever had, and here's Harold Wilson on the night of the general election. And the reason I'm playing this actually is because it was on BBC Parliament last week, and I just thought it was a real breath of fresh air to see how things used to be done.
I think that it could provide a period of parliamentary stability. I cannot see all the third and fourth and fifth and splinter parties uniting in a kind of opposition coalition of nationalist unity.
Unholy alliances. You
I have used that phrase, yes. I can't see them uniting in that to provoke a third election. We shall carry out our programme, our manifesto. We shall give priority, of course, to putting on the statute book all the things that we have said, like public ownership of land, legislation against discrimination against women.
Will some of those things receive greater emphasis than others?
Well, you better wait for the Queen's speech, which my colleagues and I will be meeting to prepare the Queen's speech for the new Parliament as early as possible, after we've had a good weekend's sleep.
Martin, after he's had a good weekend's sleep, what a sweet touch. Lovely man. Anyway, he's talking about nationalisation of development land there. He's saying basically, look, if the house building industry or people aren't doing what they're supposed to be doing, we're just going to come in and nationalise the land.
Yes, it's another era, but not necessarily one that's irrelevant to our current circumstances, eh? And don't forget, of course, he'd also won the election after the miners' strike of 1972 and 74. And the Tories had gone to the country in 1972 saying, who runs the country, us or the miners? And the answer of the country was, well, definitely not you. And, of course, then the second election in 74 put the Labour Party not in full charge, but in enough charge to do what the kind of things it wanted to do. But as you say, when we were off air, that's when the establishment really decided to take Wilson down. And of course MI5 decided he was working for the Russians, and therefore that they were justified in bugging his phones, etc. People who've seen the film,
well, they said he was a Russian agent.
Yeah, they said, for people who've seen the BBC Two docudrama, the Wilson plot
with Mark Bolan, was very good.
Talking about, yeah.
There's another one as well. Sorry, I can just say there's another one. A very British coup. You've seen that?
That's all. What's the word? It's all.
It's a dramatisation.
Dramatisation.
Oh no, yeah.
Whereas the Wilson plot is a docudrama. It's based on real stuff. Mm.
Okay, so let's just wind up by saying, I mean, I know on Wednesday there were 150,000 signatures, Rob, saying that there was that this was no good. What's the Green Party going to do about it? Are you actually going to get a debate with Caroline Lucas?
Well, I think the legal challenge, you know, it may have to be made. I mean, that's what we've threatened so far. I say we, it wasn't me, it was my decision, obviously, but someone in London. Oh God, that sounds terrible, doesn't it? But what I'm saying is that I think we're going to probably have to go through with that, because it is getting to that stage where it's an absolute joke the fact that we're not getting coverage. We've had a huge increase in the number of members. I mean, in Bristol alone in the last year, we've put on 200 members, I think. And that's just a city. I mean, across the country, we've actually increased hugely. We're on about, I think...
You did pretty well in Scotland, didn't you, on the back of the independence.
Whenever I hear political parties saying about their amazing numbers of members, I always like to remind them that there are 15 times more members of trade unions in Britain, and that those trade unions, most of them anyway, are more democratic than the political parties.
Well,
but anyway, so you're doing quite well here in Bristol. Anyway, well, we hope to see, something done about this, because it rather annoys me to think that big mainstream media think they can control the discussion, control the debate, and focus it all at the very top of the parties when they're clear that whole process clearly isn't working and it's alienating the voters. Mm. Anyway, Bristol has a duty to tackle homelessness, so let's be bold. This is Ian Onions writing in the Post just about a week ago. It's not unusual to see rough sleepers lying in Bristol's doorways and subways, but they're just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to homelessness in the city. A summit on the issue was told. Most of today's homeless are people in rented accommodation whose tenancies have come to an end. They could also be the victims of domestic abuse. Mayor George Ferguson said relatively wealthy cities such as Bristol have a duty to help the homeless because the cost of housing was more expensive. He said homeless people often had nowhere to call their own because of circumstances beyond their control. But what's he actually doing about it, Rob?
I think the council and the mayor in particular have got...
You can tell there's an election coming, can't you?
Why?
Well, because it's taken two and a half years or so for Ferguson to actually start coming out with this stuff, and then there's,
I think he's mentioned it before. I don't think he's... Yeah, I think you're right to say.
What are we going to do about it, though?
Well, I mean... I can only speak from my own experience. When the biggest homelessness issue in my ward, in Ashley Ward, is most seen through people living in caravans on the street. Now, that's legal. You're allowed to live on the street in a caravan. Now, we have homelessness workers going in and knocking on the windows and doors of these caravans to find out whether these people want to be accommodated in a different way. Often the case where they've chosen to live that way. I can't say... I've had someone come to me in my, 1.5 years of being a councillor and asked about homelessness. I've had people, you know, send me a chain email maybe about the issue of homelessness. So from that respect, I think it's dropped off the radar of a lot of people's consciousness.
One of the things they're saying in this report in the Post is that you've got four times more in the last couple of years street homeless, people who are sleeping rough in the city. That's just the official figures, and if you talk to the people that run the Wild Goose Cafe that feeds people, they'll say the figures are probably three or four times that.
And this is the effect of the austerity measures that central government has placed on Bristol, is that they don't have the same resource that they used to tackle these things. And it's across the board, you know. It's not just in homelessness services. I'm not changing the subject, but you know, in highways departments, we've lost staff. In areas of the council where you would normally say this is off limits, you can't get rid of people. You know, in housing, in safeguarding, you know. These are areas that we shouldn't be having to cut back on. But the austerity measures are forcing councils into this impossible situation where they've got to choose between services. Homelessness is something that's been cut, and I'm not aware there's been a major cut, but if it has been cut, it needs to be ring-fenced. We need to make sure in this year's budget that we actually ring-fence homelessness prevention. And that's what it takes. It takes prevention. It takes people going out onto the streets, talking to those people who are sleeping rough, and trying to find them accommodation. The council should have accommodation for all the people in Bristol who are sleeping rough.
Yeah, but
it's a case that we need to just get those people into the accommodation.
Martin, 41 people now sleeping rough in the city centre, according to official figures, up more than four times in a year.
Yeah, well, don't forget that people who are homeless often are not registered to vote. And they are the classic marginalised group. So unless those who are in a more fortunate circumstances are prepared to take a stand on their behalf, the chances are that they are going to be back of the queue. And of course, the fundamental thing is that we've completely destroyed the social housing policies of two generations after the Second World War. We've now had a generation where we've actually done nothing in real terms to solve the problems of social housing. And I see that the Labour Party's commitments to doing something about housing are all based on right to buy, and you know, we're going to give people the right to buy houses who from the local area. I see Miliband was saying the other day.
Well, we heard this from Kerry a couple of weeks ago. For many it's of the been in the news here, this week.
Yeah. Right to buy is absolutely irrelevant. It makes no difference to their circumstances whatsoever.
But doesn't people moving out of rented into buying their own places, doesn't that start to actually open the market up for others?
No, it doesn't. Because nobody is prepared to grasp the nettle which the Conservative government of the 1950s grasped and said, we are going to have to provide decent housing for people on low incomes, which will be owned by the government, effectively. And nobody, not even the Labour Party, wants to say this, even though it's staring us in the face as an obvious thing to do. Well, we don't want another housing bubble subsidised by the government. That's absolutely absurd.
I'm going to lean in and do that annoying thing that Green Party politicians do, which is to say the Green Party does, because we want to build the next generation of 21st century council housing that is fit for purpose, retrofitted, energy efficient, that keeps people out of fuel poverty. It gives them a safe place, a secure home. That's our policy. That's what we want to see happen. So vote for us.
Well, I agree with that, and I'm glad that you're saying it, because we ought to be saying it, and if you say it, it's more chance that our people will pick it up.
Okay. Hopefully what will happen,
I went last weekend to the Oxford House of the Commons conference, and I met there a chap called Pete Beard. He's from Squash, Squatters Action for Secure Homes. This seems to me to be the obvious thing to do. If you've got hundreds of empty buildings, as we have in this city, landowners actually bulldozing them. If you go on Temple Way, you'll see that they've been bulldozed, because they haven't got anyone to rent them. And actually what they're doing is they're not actually developers at all, they're just land speculators who are sitting on the land waiting for the price of the land to go up with all this quantitative easing. Let's just put the homeless people together with the empty buildings. But anyway, let's have a listen to see what Pete Beard from Squash had to say.
We need to take direct action to embarrass the politicians until we start taking direct action. I mean, if we move within the parameters of what the people in power consider to be acceptable spaces and acceptable methods of making our points, then we're never going to change that. And squatting is a great example of direct action. We've seen here in Oxford people taking direct action by occupying a long-term disused electric power station and turning that into a four-day conference on housing. That sort of stuff is what we need. We need to be taking space, because space as well as time are the two biggest resources that we have as human beings. And in a world where they're privatising everything with a heartbeat, the most potent thing that we can do is occupy space. Occupy London have been a great example of this, how dangerous that is to people in power. They've now passed bylaws in London to stop people even from having a tent pole in certain parts of London. They're so scared by the polythene tent. And I think squatting is one way that we can take direct action when it comes to housing.
That was Pete Beard. He also blogs at a blog space called Pete the Temp, from the Oxford conference that I went along to last weekend about housing and squatting. George Ferguson is urging the experts, he calls them, not to be afraid to come up with innovative ways to tackle the issue, and said he was happy to see Bristol become a testbed for new ideas. Well, what about squatting?
Well, squatting's been there all along, hasn't it? It's been the government's tried to criminalise aspects of it. But the real problem is that we've had this MIPIM conference in London this week for the first time, which was usually held in Cannes, and this is where the developers wine and dine the chief executives of all of the local authorities to get them to release land for their purposes.
So do we know if anyone from Bristol went to MIPIM?
Well, I'd imagine Bristol would be
selling off our land to these big developers. If you go into St Paul's, now let's talk about that piece of land in St Paul's which was bought by Places for People. Or is it 6 years ago or something?
Yep.
7 years ago, maybe? And they said, we're going to have a great big development here. Nothing at all has happened. They're just sitting on the land waiting for the price to go up.
I've had some quite cross words with Places for People about this one in the past. I mean, I'm sure they're doing good stuff in other places, but in that site on Dove Lane. I mean, for me, it's worrying. The three major applications I've seen in our ward in the last 3 or 4 months are for student accommodation. Now, we're not really near the university in St Paul's, and in, you know, Montpellier.
But that's not what St Paul's near. What do people want? Isn't it probably more like 2-3 bedroom homes for families? Isn't
that's what people are after. And you know, I mean, there's been this whole contentious issue about the carriage works in the last few months, because there's this sort of predatory developer coming in, putting at risk, you know, the plans that Knightstone, a housing association, have to put in place family homes, mixed use, but family homes, some apartments that would actually benefit the residents of my ward and St Paul's. And we are so frustrated that these developments, when they do come about, they don't serve the interests of the community. They're just speculative, and they are about making money. I was going to mention another aspect of this, which isn't to do perhaps with homelessness, but to do with the temporary nature of accommodation. There's a really key campaign at the moment, the Acorn Bristol campaign, where they're looking at the private rental sector, and just basically the way that a lot of landlords in the private rental sector just don't care about their tenants. They don't look out for the interests of those tenants. There's mould growing on the walls, but also the more general things, like they offer, you know, rolling contracts, so you can only get a one month or 2 month contract after, and you have to keep renewing it. And just how unstable and insecure living like that is for a lot of people in Bristol.
Martin, isn't there something sort of at the heart of everything about this housing? Because housing is what, you know, it basically, most people spend most of their income on housing, whether they're renting or whether they're paying their mortgage, and it's simply broken. The whole system is broken.
Yes, and also if you think about the macroeconomic impacts of this, the obsession with home ownership in Britain started in the 1920s. Conservative government, Baldwin, said what we're going to do is we're going to create conditions where the largest possible number of people will be able to buy their own homes, or rather go into debt to buy their own homes, because we want them to have a stake in the society. So he was the one who framed came up with the term property owning democracy. Now, of course, in other words, what we're talking about here is social engineering in a conservative direction. And in actual fact, the government has basically rigged the system. There's no free market in housing. There's a rigged system to encourage home ownership. Now, if you look at other countries in Scandinavia, for example, they don't have that at all.
No.
There's no idea that people are going to own their own houses, and that's what this is all about. And we're so used to this in Britain that we've still got a Labour front bench who are talking in terms of creating affordable houses for people to buy, which is just more of the same nonsense that we've had for the last 30 years. And in the past, people used to know about this. The bottom third of a society, if you're going to have a free market economy with different differential wages, the bottom third of a society simply cannot afford decent places to live. So the state must step in, and there's no ifs, no buts. That's the only way to do it.
Maybe they could live in a shanty town.
That's where we're going.
I was also speaking to Green Party councillor in Oxford, Elise Benjamin, about this when I was at the conference last weekend called the Oxford House of the Commons.
I'm Elise Benjamin. I am a city councillor and right in the belly of the devil. And because of that, I want to do something better for housing than the council is doing.
Well, we've got a serious housing crisis in the country. Does the Green Party actually have any policies to do with housing which are practical? Because there's a lot of good ideas, but the money doesn't seem to be there for them.
Well, the money is there. Once you get inside a council, you get to understand how things are funded. And councils can build housing. They can work with local groups like community land trusts and co-housing projects, but they can also build their own housing. They can borrow against reserves, they can prudentially borrow, they can do things like phase refurbishments. They can even have tenants in on a peppercorn rent on housing that needs to be refurbished while they work on the refurbishments. So there are all sorts of creative things that councils can do. It's just that they're not doing them.
Why not, Rob?
Well, I think they should be, and I think the reason why they're not is political will. I think the strange thing is, I mean, as Martin's mentioned, is nearly all the political parties will say we want to build more houses, and we want to build 21st century houses that are retrofitted, that are actually energy efficient, that give people low energy bills and a safe and secure home. No one's going to disagree with that.
But it's all talk, isn't it? I mean, event that took place last week, just trying to find what it was. It was a summit at the Pavilion in the Harbourside, apparently, about housing and homelessness. I didn't know about it either. I mean, someone who's involved in squatting group in Bristol, we thought maybe possibly we could have been asked along to give our point of view, but no. So we all know that it's possible. Why not? Why doesn't there seem to be political will, Martin?
Well, let's face it. I'll leave the macroeconomic impacts of having a big property market like we do in Britain on one side, but of course it actually creates all kinds of problems for the management of macroeconomic policy, including management of things like interest rates and so on. But don't forget that there is a fundamental commitment. I mean, the right to buy is actually geared at getting those people in the marginal constituencies who might be given some subsidy by the government, be get on the housing ladder, to help those people so that the government can win the election. It's as cynical as that. So we can't spend any money on homeless people because they've got no votes and who cares anyway. But we can spend money on people in the middling income who haven't quite got enough to get on the housing ladder. The taxpayer, that means everybody else, is going to pay for them to get on the housing ladder. And that's a very popular thing because it's free money. But of course, it's got damn all to do with a free market economy. A free market economy really would be a free market economy. And in actual fact, for example, you'd allow the banks to collapse and allow the property market to collapse. So everybody who's basically had their nest eggs in their houses would lose their money. But that's free market.
Mark Martin, you're perfectly segueing into the next story. The jittery stock market lurches into the red again after growth fears see £46 billion wiped off leading UK shares in one day. That was Wednesday. We also had problems, I think, with the Far East markets in Japan and the markets in the US. Everyone's saying, well, most people, commentators seem to be saying, this is due to problems with the Greek debt and the fact that the Greeks might default. But anyway, what's your analysis?
Well, there's a variety of things that are causing the jitters. There's the Greeks, there's the conflict in the Ukraine, there's the conflict in the Middle East, and that the main problem is that at the end of this month, on October the 31st, the US Federal Reserve has said it's going to stop printing money. Now, that's when they said that this time last year, it caused a panic, because in actual fact, I don't think they can stop printing money. I think between now and October the 31st, they're going to decide that they can carry on printing money, and Mario Draghi, who runs the European Central Bank, will have his arm twisted mightily by the City of London and others, that he should start printing money, although Angela Merkel has told him that he can't.
Well, Barclays have said that the European Central Bank definitely will, by the end of the year, be printing money.
Yeah, but the Germans are still aren't happy. You'll find that Angela's not actually
going to reconcile. So what's going on here is actually the economy is tanking, and the only way you can actually keep it moving, make it look like something's going on and keep the figures up, is number one, add things like prostitution and drugs to the figures. Yes. And the other one is to keep QE. Now, what about the Greens, Rob? What would you guys be and girls be doing with the economy? Because it does seem like nobody is prepared to actually bite the bullet to face the music.
I kind of had a little smirk on my face when I saw this story, because yesterday I was sitting in a council meeting. And I was sitting next to a Conservative councillor, and he was looking he was looking at his stocks and shares just before going into the meeting. He seemed to be quite worried.
Which councillor was that then?
Oh, I don't know if I should name names.
Why not?
Councillor Galandris.
Oh, right, my favourite councillor, who never replies to emails or phone calls, right, and who works for a bank.
Well, there we go. He must be very worried about this. But to go back to your original question of what we do about it, one of the key aspects of the thing that we'll be plugging in the next, you know, 6-7 months is it basically splitting the banks. We have the system where the banks are dependent on the financial markets and on the financial services industry. What we need to do is make sure that people who have money in banks have that as safe.
Martin, the Treasury Select Committee, Andrew Tyrie chairs it, Conservative MP, they said they were going to do this, 2 years ago almost?
Yes, and
of course they're not going to do it.
The vested interests have basically sabotaged it at every turn.
Is that simply so that the casino bankers can suck in all our personal money into their casino?
I do agree with what Rob's saying there, but the problem is that's what should have happened immediately after the crash in 2008. Mm. We're now in a situation where reform of the system is really becoming by the by. What will happen, they will carry on printing money, the ECB will probably print, the Federal Reserve will probably carry on printing, but at a certain point then the geopolitics of the situation will cause a crash of the dollar, which will pull the whole... All that has to happen, if interest rates rise even by a tiny bit, the Bank of International Settlements has said there's going to be a crash. So I'm not the only person saying this. And I think the fact is, it could happen before the next election, Rob, in which case we're going to be in a completely different ball game. We're not going to be in Kansas anymore if there is a worldwide crash as a result of the capitalist system based in the City of London going down the drain. We're not talking about reforming it anymore, are we?
So forgive my ignorance. What stops us from doing that now, then? What stops us from splitting retail banking from casino banking?
What's stopping us is the political power of the bankers. what you said earlier about, right, you know, okay, this is what Milton Friedman's argument against bailing out industries was quite straightforward. He said if you bail out an industry, whether it's a steel industry, a coal industry, or a financial services industry, the problem is you can justify that by saying, well, once they get over the problem, they'll be back, get back into profit, and then we can get the money back. But the problem is that what happens is the industry concerned, steel, coal, whatever it is, financial services, they just take the money and then they come back for more, and they keep coming back for more until you say we haven't got any more. The financial services industry has been an object lesson in why bailing out industries is a mug's game. Because it doesn't matter how much money you chuck at it, they're always going to come back for more.
We've got to remember though that as much as this is the orthodoxy, you know, free markets, markets aren't free. The state controls
this one certainly
the markets
isn't,
to some extent.
Without the intervention of the state, the financial services industry would simply not be there. It would have vaporised.
Okay, guys, next story. UK deficit is a similar subject. The UK deficit has ballooned £48 billion above the 2010 forecast as the Treasury is hit by a £25 billion hole in income tax receipts. Funnily enough, they're also closing 14 of their Inland Revenue HMRC offices, so they're going to be able to collect surely even less. They're hoping that automation is going to be collecting everybody's banks, so they're sacking people from and then they're wondering why they've got £25 billion hole in income tax receipts. It just seems like the wheels are coming off the wagon.
That's true, but I think also I used to teach A-level economics, and what I would say to my students is, can you explain the relationship between the fact that the economy is growing a bit and that the deficit is increasing? Or rather not going down as fast as it should have been. I mean, don't forget, Balls was saying at the very beginning it's going to take at least two parliaments to get the deficit down, and the Tories say, oh no we won't, we're going to do it in one parliament. Of course they haven't done it in one parliament. It's going to take at least two.
Rob,
but the real problem is that the if you're going to get in, just let me make this point because it's an important point.
Get on with it, please. Finish it.
The important point is that the growth we're having in the economy is because the deficit is growing up. If the deficit was going down, we wouldn't have any growth. And my A-star students will be able to explain to me why, but none of the people in charge of the government.
The deficit, £48 billion. This is money, in an article, 16th of October. That's yesterday, in fact. The Daily Mail, basically, Empire, this is part of, £48 billion above the forecast, the 2010 forecast, and a £28 billion hole in income tax receipts. Now, this just sounds like a total disaster. Like, basically, the economy's going off a cliff, and the only way, I suppose, to keep that sort of thing going is by printing money.
Yeah. Well, I think no one doubts now, I think, that investment in the economy is the key aspect. If you don't invest in the economy, the law of diminishing returns. It's going to keep returning poorer and poorer returns. What we need is an investment in green jobs. That's what we've always been calling for in the Green Party, the Green New Deal, the idea that we promote, you know, retrofitting of houses, huge returns in manufacturing, so that we actually get British products, but also an opportunity for people to take on roles within the economy that are sustainable. If you give someone a job in construction, they aren't going to keep it for that long, because after they've built the house, where do they go? But if you give them jobs in retrofitting, and we have a huge amount of housing stock that needs retrofitting, so that their houses are energy efficient, that is a huge boon to the economy. It gives people a job, it gives them money to spend, that goes back into the economy, and it improves everyone's well-being.
And that isn't happening, is it? Another interesting article this week: pay squeeze is the worst since the Victorian age, a study finds. This is in The Guardian. And I think it's quoting a TUC report, Guardian Observer anyway, last Saturday. British workers are suffering the longest and severest decline in real earnings since the mid-Victorian era, according to a new analysis. Research carried out by the TUC suggests the UK would have had to go back to the 1860s for a pay squeeze so deep and so long as the current one. This year is the seventh consecutive year of falling real earnings for UK workers, a situation, it says, has no historical precedent. The body, which represents 6 million workers, calculates there has been an 8% fall in real earnings between 2007 and now. Martin, this is just appalling for ordinary people, for households, and obviously that means that people are not going to be able to be paying so much tax. It means that basically the whole entire austerity measures have been a disaster and a failure.
Well, what used to happen in the golden age of capitalism from 1945 to 1973 is, because of strong trade unions in countries like Britain and the US, what would happen is, what you expect to happen in a capitalist economy is, because of the progress of technology, productivity per worker rises. Yeah, because you've got more, you've got a better technology, you've got computers now, whereas people used to have to use card file indexes and what have you. Now, if you don't, if that isn't translated into higher wages for the workers, then ultimately you've got a problem with demand in the economy. Because don't forget that all these workers all over the world who've had their wages depressed are the ultimate consumers. So real wages in the US haven't risen since 1973. And how do they fill the gap? They borrow the money. But of course, borrowing the money only puts off the dreadful day until the crash comes, and then the crash comes.
Okay, Rob, this is from the EU Observer on a similar topic. I mean, we mentioned the sex and drugs driving the surge in growth. This is the apparent surge in economic growth. This is, the headline is, sex and drugs drive the EU growth surge. The apparent surge in economic growth is not the result of increased spending or output, will not make anyone feel richer. Instead, it's the product of a new accounting system used by the EU statistical agency to calculate economic activity, which includes sectors ranging from research and development to drug trafficking and prosecution. I mean, we were talking about this with Charlotte Leslie last week. Apparently, research and development used to be put into some kind of speculative lump. Now it's investment, and it's almost counted like assets on a balance sheet. So what's happening is, the accountants at the EU are starting to shuffle and shift large quantities of money around within the accounts in order to make it look like there's growth.
That sounds terrible. I don't know this story in much detail, but basically, yeah, I mean, it just seems to be the same problem we've been talking about for most of the programme here, is that...
Well, military spending, for example, in this new methodology, it says here, is classed now as an investment in the future.
Well, an investment in killing people.
This is one of the problems with JNP statistics altogether, because everything is included. So pollution, for example, you know, if you pollute something and then clean it up, that increases your JNP. So it measures both goods and bads. But the reason why they've included these things in the growth figures is because it makes the deficit debt figures look a bit better, so that it puts off the dreadful day of default and all the rest of it.
Okay.
So in other words, we're now searching down the back of the sofa to try and find anything that we can.
The legislation putting the rules in place through the EU attracted almost no attention when it was adopted by MEPs and ministers in 2012. Will give the bloc its fastest economic growth rate since 2007.
Yes, but of course nothing's changed at all apart from the measure of the growth. I mean, in principle, I think the idea of including things like drugs and prostitution in the growth figures is perfectly logical. It's very difficult.
But the only reason they're doing it now is just
they're doing it
good.
Now because it makes
an election
look
coming
a bit better. Now, what they're trying to do is keep the show on the road so that there isn't a default. If Greece defaults, for example, that will then trigger all these derivative contracts, and the derivatives market is now about a third bigger than it was at the time of the crash in 2008. So if Greece defaults, then everybody who's bet on Greece not defaulting loses their money, and the whole pack of cards goes down. And Greece is only a small country, but even a small country like that defaulting can bring the whole thing down.
Let's leave it there. I think we can just say they're fixing the figures, folks. They're fixing the figures. Tory MP disabled should work for less than the minimum wage. Tory backbencher Philip Davis has caused outrage today by telling Parliament that disabled people should work for less than the minimum wage. Well, that's not the big story this week with Lord Freud. That was from 2011. Another Conservative MP, in fact, Lord Freud was a Lord, not an MP, no one's ever elected him. This is a bit worrying, isn't it? I think when you hear this kind of talk, that disabled people are worth less than others.
It's deeply worrying, and what I find so mendacious about it, and it's just terrifying, really, that people in Lord Freud's position are making comments like this, because people who are disabled have borne the brunt of this government's austerity measures. They're the people who have effectively been living the nightmare. Some of us have been affected, but the disabled people in this country have been the worst affected. I think it's up to us as local politicians, if we truly believe in a fair society, to stand up for disabled people in this time. And I think what it also shows is that there's a real sense within the right wing parties, and by that I do mean the Conservatives and UKIP in this instance, that they can say things like this that will raise the hackles of the right demographic of people that they think they want to get their votes. This is what you've just been saying about the economy. It's trying to show a different way of looking at people and show them up to be less than people.
Martin, this is something a little bit fascist about this idea of seeing disabled people and able-bodied people just as different kind of quantities on an economic treadmill.
Well, that's right. I mean, when all this idea of putting people who are disabled or sick on to work, I often feel like saying, well, now which employers are going to employ these people? You know, people with mental health issues.
Remploy would have done.
Well, Remploy would have done, but Remploy's been got rid of. If this was communist Cuba, then every work detail will be given to disabled people to integrate into their work detail. But then communist Cuba isn't run on a for-profit basis. Mm. And if you're going to say we're going to have a free market economy, which is run by private firms who are pursuing private profit, then they're not going to want to employ people with mental health issues, are they?
Do you think?
I mean, that's just the reality.
Rob, so do you think it's bizarre? Do you think it betrays something else going on behind the scenes? Because I mean, a lot of politicians I meet, I mean, they'll smile very sweetly, they'll talk very nicely on the radio, but actually, you know, deep down, maybe, for example, they are a racist.
Yeah, well, I'm not going to get into naming people as racist, but yeah, no, there are some there are some politicians who do hold those views.
But that's even more disturbing, I think, when it comes to disabled people, particularly because of the history of eugenics, this kind of thing. Yeah. Actually, it's literally treating people... go on, Martin.
Can I just pick up on what you said? I mean, they're hoping that the demographics they need to win under a first-past-the-post election like the idea that poor people and people who are disabled are getting a kicking. But I'm afraid if that's what they want to do, they've got to take the comeback from people like the Church of England and others saying, we don't approve of this. Mm. And they can't have it both ways. They can't have the approval of the Archbishop of Canterbury and go around kicking sand in disabled people's faces. It's one or the other.
Okay, meanwhile, this week we've had a protest at plans to cut beds for disabled children here in Bristol. Passionate protesters descended on City Hall to fight the plan to cut 5 out of 10 beds at the Bush Unit for Disabled Children in Hengrove. The facility provides overnight respite for parents and carers, plus support, stimulation, and a safe place for their children to meet friends. Rita Lynch's son, Jimmy, who was on our sister programme, Dialect, which is on a Monday at 11, by the way, 13, has been going there one night a week for the past 3 years. Rita of Montpellier said Jimmy's autism makes it very difficult for him to make friends. Since he has been using the bush, his communication and social skills have improved greatly. I mean, these places are actually really valuable, really important for disabled people, yet here in Bristol too, disabled people seem to be at the bottom of the list.
Yeah, can I, Rita's actually a resident of my ward, and I've met her and her son Jimmy. He's a lovely, lovely kid, and Gus and I have met her many times, and we've been...
That's your fellow Green Councillor.
Yeah, fellow Green Councillor and Ashley Ward. We've been advocating for her, and we don't think these beds should be cut. We made that very, very clearly as a plea at the Cabinet meeting. The argument is going that, basically, if you have five beds, if you take these five beds away, the money that you save can then be put into giving more choice to more families. Now, I'm not going to deny that. That's probably true financially. But my argument on the day was that choice is the thing we should be questioning. Just giving choice isn't actually the end thing that we want. What we want to do is give people security and let them know that the service is going to be there. If they've got used to it, and a lot of these kids, if they're on the autism spectrum, don't deal well with change. If they've got used to this way of providing respite care, which is vital for mothers like Rita who need respite care and need that support from the council, then they must keep those beds there. Unfortunately, the decision has gone against us. The mayor decided not to keep the beds. He's decided that he is going to go with the choice angle. And we'll just keep trying to stand up for these people who are trying to keep the services that have been so, you know, so loved by residents, actually. They're services that are genuinely loved by people.
Martin, this is the sharp end of the austerity cuts happening to disabled people here in Bristol on the same week as we had Lord Freud saying that disabled people were only worth £2 an hour.
Yes, and when we think about the corruption at the top in the financial services industry and the sweeteners that are being given by people to buy houses in swing constituencies so that the government can get re-elected, it's a disgrace. I mean, and of course, the bailing out of the financial services sector in 2008 means that we have definitively moved beyond having a capitalist free market economy. If anybody from the UKIP or the Conservative Party starts talking about free market economy, I just say, shut up, we haven't got a free market economy, we bail the banks out. Free market economy is history, and it is history. And of course, if the crash comes before the next election in May, it really will be history, because then we won't be talking about any of this stuff at all. We'll be talking about something completely different.
Chris Grayling's legal aid cuts so unfair they are illegal, rules the High Court. This was actually a few weeks ago, Friday 19th of September, Chris Grayling, the Secretary of State for Justice, acted illegally in trying to drive through multi-million pound legal aid cuts that could have led to the closure of hundreds of legal firms, a High Court judge ruled. The government's been told to halt its cost-cutting plans for legal aid payments for duty solicitors at police stations. Under the plans, the work currently carried out by 1,600 firms would be limited to 525 contracts, leading to closures and mergers of high street legal firms attempting to make the new system pay. High Court ruled the government had failed to properly consult with the profession over the changes, notably in a report by KPMG into finance of the shake-up. That's interesting, KPMG again, everywhere, their fingerprints seem to be all over this austerity disaster, the financial collapse, you know, doing the accounts of the banks in the run-up to 2008, helping out Mayor Ferguson with his...
But they're in favour of a living wage. Do you know that, Tony?
KPMG are.
Yeah, they come along to all the living wage events the council puts on. It's quite funny. I mean, yeah. For obvious reasons, because they can flipping afford it.
amazing to see KPMG involved in this one too. The decision means that part of the process will have to be repeated. Anyway, Martin, the Chris Grayling is actually breaking the law by trying to do all these legal aid cuts to duty solicitors.
Well, we're talking about things that should be there but are not there, whether it's beds for disabled children or legal aid for people who haven't got money. And, of course, we're saying we've got to cut this back because, I mean, and I think it was very clear from the Conservative Party conference, they made it absolutely clear, there's no money for anything, we're going to have to cut welfare bill, we're going to have to cut this, cut that, but there is money for tax cuts for our people. Now, that is just completely cynical. They're basically taking money, it's the Robin Hood in reverse. We're taking money off the poor to give it to our supporters who are rich. And that's their electoral strategy. And but it's got nothing to do with the free market, of course. It's free. Middle-class people in this country hate handouts for the poor, but they don't hate handouts. They just hate handouts for the poor. Handouts for them are fine.
One of the things, I just looked up an older index of the rich and the poor. Oxfam said at the World Economic Forum earlier this year in January, 85 richest people in the world are as wealthy as the poorest half of the entire world. Yeah. I'll just say that again. The 85 richest people are now as wealthy as the poorest half of the entire world. At yacht parties in Cairns, councils have been selling out homes. Martin mentioned this briefly a little earlier on. This is the organisation that's or a meeting, isn't it, that's been selling our homes, but it was actually blockaded by protesters this week.
Yes, who were single mums who'd been occupying a block in East London to claim, you know, they want to they're all from East London. In the past, they would have been given council housing in the areas where they came from.
Yes, now, it's called MIPIM, MIPIM, and that's where a lot of our land and development land's being sold off to these speculators. Yes. We won't call them developers because quite often they don't do anything with the land.
No, but you can see where the vested interests come from in our society. If you rig the system as it has been rigged in the interests of the possessor principle, those who have shall be given, then of course it makes perfect sense to carry on doing exactly that. So, but I just pick up again on the contradiction in David Cameron's position, saying there's no money for anything. We're all in it together. We're going to have to cut. Everybody's got to tighten their belts, but not us. You. You've got to tighten your belts. We don't tighten our belts. More handouts for our people.
No, we haven't seen the merchant venturers tightening their belts either.
I was going to say, I hope to God that none of our council representatives are at this shindig. It's actually worth a freedom of information request, isn't it? I mean, just to find out whether Bristol City Council has been involved in this. I mean, if it's made the grave for the Guardian, it's, you know, pretty much up there.
Okay, Rob, one for you here, and this is in your ward. Residents of Morgan Street in Bristol have won their fight against RPZ for their road. This is Louis Emmanuel in the Bristol Post. The residents in Morgan Street in St Paul's during their recent street protest against a residents' parking zone. A major battle has been won in the war against the residents' parking zones in St Paul's Morgan Street, where protests have blockaded contractors from painted new permit bays will no longer be included in the scheme. The road will become the only place to park a car for free in the area when the St Paul's scheme goes live next Monday. So are these heroes or villains?
Heroes. I mean, it's you know, they've taken matter into their own hands. I mean, I don't agree with breaking the law, and it's not going to produce perhaps a good outcome for them, because potentially everyone who knows about this protest and the resulting fact that they will not have the residence parking scheme will go and park in their street. On the other hand, at the end of the day, they've chosen that, and that's their right.
Well, I don't know that much about this situation. I find I think the things about parking zones is very difficult. I mentioned the city centre in Gloucester, where they completely pedestrianise it, and as a visitor to the city, it's fantastic. But of course, it did have big distributional effects. Certain businesses had to close, and there were changes that people didn't like as a result of that. What I think was essentially positive policy.
I'd actually like to thank the residents of Morgan Street, because they decided to do their protest the one week of the year that I was on holiday. So it was Gus who had to deal with that and talk to the residents and find out what the concern was. The main thing they were saying was they wanted Cabot Circus to pay for it. That was their main protest. They were saying that Cabot Circus isn't built. We haven't seen anything out of that. We haven't seen any financial benefit out of that.
Why they're saying that is because particularly on a Sunday, or particularly at weekends, St Paul's has been absolutely covered with cars from people who are coming in from Gloucestershire and elsewhere who don't want to park in the car park at Cabot Circus, the whole place. Yeah. I mean, it's been a car park for years, hasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, the yellow lines that have just gone in have actually made... I mean, if you know Newfoundland Road, which is the one that runs right alongside the M32 on the home stretch into town, it's been absolutely wonderful the last few days because the yellow lines have gone down. I've been actually able to cycle in the cycle lane. It's been quiet. You've been able to get through. It's really nice, actually. What I'm worried about is that other people will take this Morgan Street example and say...
good, I hope they do, because for many people, they see this just as just another tax, isn't it? The tax to park outside your house tax.
Yeah, I agree with that, and I don't think that residents...
The council should supply at cost.
Well, I agree, but where's the money coming from?
Well, if it costs the council 15 quid to issue a permit, then that's fine, and it should cost that. Not, I mean, what's going to happen now is the price is just going to go up and up and up, as they always do.
Well, yeah, okay, we'll hope that doesn't happen.
Anyway, that's all for now. Time for the Murdoch News at 6 now. You've been listening to Rob Telford, who's the Green Party councillor for Ashley Ward. After the news, the bully banks. People fight back against crooked banksters.
On 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6, four men have appeared in court on terror offences, accused of allegedly planning an attack on London and taking an oath of allegiance to Islamic State. A fifth man also appeared before magistrates, accused of firearms offences. They've all been remanded in custody. Experts have admitted they didn't do enough to stop the spread of Ebola in West Africa. The World Health Organization has blamed incompetent staff and a lack of information, according to a leaked internal document. Doctors Without Borders raised the alarm in March. Andre Heller-Parash works for them.
We're not concerned with blame, with shaming of anyone right now. We're concerned with seeing to it that a maximum number of treatment facilities get opened immediately and that they're run safely. Safe delivery of care is what's required today.
It's reported a deal's been reached in Nigeria to release more than 200 schoolgirls who were taken by Islamist militants. They were kidnapped by the group Boko Haram 6 months ago. Military officials said truce has been agreed. The prosecution has accused Oscar Pistorius of using his disability to avoid a prison sentence for shooting his girlfriend. Elizabeth Williams reports.
Prosecutor Harry Nell managed to deliver one final piece of drama as he called for a lengthy jail term for the athlete.
The minimum term that society will be happy with will be 10 years in prison.
But the Paralympian sobbed as his lawyer Barry Roux argued he was already serving the toughest punishment of all.
He's lost everything. He lost all his sponsors. He lost all his money. He has nothing, my lady.
We'll hear on Tuesday whether Oscar Pistorius will end up behind bars.
The FTSE 100 has rebounded from its 15-month low at the end of a turbulent week, at one point falling around 5%, but easing concerns over the state of the US economy helped it rally today. And Warwick Davis has confirmed he's going to be in the new Star Wars movie. The actor previously featured in The Phantom Menace and Return of the Jedi as an Ewok. That's the latest. I'm Barry Weir.